Hey, everybody, and welcome to Learning from Smart People. I appreciate you being here with us today. My guest is Michael Hengson. He is a blind number one New York Times bestselling author who survived being on the 78th floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. He considers life an adventure to be enjoyed and lived to the fullest. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Your story obviously is fascinating. And so I would love to start just there. Can you tell us a little bit about that day, about what was going on and really how you got through it?
Well, as you said, I do like to view life as an adventure. And I've been very fortunate in my life that I've been able to have jobs pretty much ongoing as we live in a world where the typical statistic is, at least in the United States, for all persons with disabilities, including blind people, that the percentage of unemployed people who are capable of being employed is something in the neighborhood of 65%, which is not anywhere near, of course, where the average unemployment statistic is for most people in the country. And it's not that we can't work, it's that people think we can't. And so it's always a matter of pushing. And that means pushing ourselves as well. So through a variety of jobs and circumstances over the years, I was eventually hired by a company called Quantum Corporation in 1999. And I was asked to open an office for them in New York City. And again, through circumstances, probably in part because of the bombing in the World Trade Center in 1993, we got a great rent for office space in the World Trade Center.
Right.
So we got 1,400 square feet of office space for $2,800 a month. $2 a square foot is just wonderful.
Yeah.
Anyway, so our office was on the 78th floor, and I would go there every day unless I was out in the field with the team that I hired to sell and deal with our products. We had to have the office because Wall Street wanted us to have a representation there. Our products, the tape backup systems we used, were the primary products that people used as a backup system for their networks, and they were required to do that by the SEC. So on September 11th, we were going to be training some resellers who were selling our products and who wanted to sell our products. So we were going to be conducting seminars, and
right.
I went in that morning. It was a typical New York fall morning, although at about 12:30 in the morning, we had a thunderstorm that came over our house, and my guide dog, poor Roselle, was very afraid of thunder and kind of kept me awake. So we went to my office down in our basement at home to keep her as much as we could away from the lightning. And I thought we could keep her away from a lot of the noises by turning up my stereo pretty loud and doing some other things, embossing some Braille documents I wanted. But God has a sense of humor, and the thunderstorm came right over our house. So Roselle was just not able to be isolated from it. Anyway, we eventually got back upstairs, went to sleep, and woke up, as I said, to a fall day that was wonderful, typical New York September day. We went in and got prepared for the seminar. A colleague of mine from our corporate office, David Frank, was in to help because he was in charge of pricing for distribution and some of our reseller people, including those in New York. So he and I were preparing a list of all the people who would be attending the seminar. We had to do that for the World Trade Center security people. We were just getting ready to print the list on stationery when the building lurched, and then it began to tip in one direction, just like it would be tipping over. And I think the best way to describe it is imagine it was a spring. Imagine a spring that you fasten to a table, and then you push the top of it, the leaves of the spring open, and then it tips and it tips. And what happened in our case is that the spring was stronger than the, as we learned later, airplane that pushed it, and it did eventually come back. But meanwhile, we had tipped about 20 feet, and
wow.
It was definitely a pretty scary thing. So after the building tipped and came back, and I had moved to the office door because I grew up in Palmdale, California, right on the San Andreas Fault, and I learned building moves, go to doorway. Well, it's really going to help if you're 78 floors up and the building falls, but hey, habits are habits. So I was standing in the doorway, and after the building became vertical again, I moved back into my office and I met Roselle coming out from under my desk. I took her leash and told her to heel, which meant to come around on my left side and to sit down, which she did. And about that time, the building dropped straight down about 6 feet. Mm-hmm. Now, the building dropped because the spring, as it were, was going back to its normal configuration. At the time, of course, that wasn't going through our minds. I had learned what to do in the case of emergencies. I spent a lot of time walking around the World Trade Center, learning the geography, doing some of it with a white cane and doing some of it with a dog. Because using a cane, I would find all the things that the dog would just go around, like kiosks in the middle of the first floor, which was a shopping mall. And there were a lot of open kiosks, people selling things and so on. And the easiest way for me to find them was to use a cane and find them and know where they were, even though if I were using Roselle, she would just go around them. Anyway, so I knew the geography, but I also spent time with the Port Authority fire and police and emergency preparedness people to understand all the issues of what to do in an emergency, where to go, and so on. Because I knew that if I were in the office alone, I had to know that stuff. But I also knew that most people would not learn it. They would just be relying on signs, which may or may not be available to them if they were in a smoke-filled area.
Right.
We didn't have that problem on September 11th, but the point is that I understood what I needed to do, so I had the knowledge. And that helped me develop a mindset that if something happened, I would know what to do. So I didn't panic on September 11th. The mindset kicked in. my friend David looked out the window and saw things above us. He started shouting, "Oh my God, there are millions of pieces of burning paper falling outside our window. The building's on fire. We got to get out of here." And I kept saying, "Slow down, David." And he said, "No, we got to get out of here." And eventually, he used what I call the big line. He said, "You don't understand. You can't see it." And then the problem wasn't what I wasn't seeing. It was what David wasn't seeing. I had sitting next to me a dog who was very calm, very quiet, yawning, being bored, essentially saying, "Who woke me up and what the heck is going on? I was having a good nap." And because of Roselle's activity and what she wasn't doing, I understood that at least at that instantaneous point in time, we were probably able to try to evacuate in an orderly way, not panic. Eventually, I got David to focus. We had guests in the office, the first arrivals for our first seminar that was to start at 9 o'clock. And so I asked David to get our guests to the stairs. Don't let them take elevators, especially because he saw fire. And I knew that in an emergency like that, you don't take elevators because especially if fire got into the elevator shafts, it would be all over for anyone who was in the cars.
Right.
So David got people to the stairs. And meanwhile, I called my wife, Karen, who had no idea of what was happening. Of course, the media hadn't gotten the story. And we talked for a second. I told her we were going to evacuate. And then David came back. We hung up, swept the offices, and went to the stairs and started down.
Yeah. And in that, it's so interesting what you are experiencing. Number one, that it's because you have a personal sense of responsibility to say, I need to make sure that I have all of the information that I need to be ready for whatever happens. But there's also, even though you can't see what's going on, you have an awareness based on the circumstances around you and what's going on with Roselle. You're able to kind of judge the amount of danger that you're in. It's such an interesting thing. And I'm assuming that, you know, things went fairly easily on your evacuation, or how did the evacuation go?
Well, they did. And, you know, to what you were just saying, you know, the problem is most people think eyesight's the only game in town. We don't grow up recognizing that there is more than one way to accomplish a task oftentimes. And there certainly is more than one way to live as opposed to just having eyesight. You know, I grew up learning that I could do whatever I chose to do. And sometimes if I couldn't do it because the technology wasn't there, I had to participate in helping to invent it, at least for me.
Right.
And then certainly as time went on, more and more technology became available. Ironically, today, in a world where we have a whole lot more technology, more and more of that technology is visual, and they're not doing the necessary things to make sure that all people can be included in using it. You know, medical devices, even the internet. So many websites and so little emphasis on accessible inclusion for all. And I've actually been recently hired by a company called Accessibee as the chief vision officer to help bring that company into the market. And it's a company that literally has made over 100,000 websites accessible already. But it's a process. And on that day, I knew that I had to know what to do, because I couldn't necessarily rely on others. And in fact, you know, David made a little bit of the wrong interpretation, although understandably so.
Right.
But it is a matter of always being prepared, and more people should learn to be prepared and should be prepared to know what to do in case of an emergency or something unexpected. We don't learn to control our fears very well. And so fear overwhelms us and overtakes us, rather than us using fear as a driving force to help us focus and do better. And so, yeah, it all did kick in and worked well. It was pretty uneventful going down the stairs. At one point, the firefighters stopped us on the 30th floor as they were coming up with all their equipment, and they wanted to help me down the stairs. And I had to fight pretty hard to keep them from, quote, helping, end of quote.
Right.
Because they would want to grab my arm and lift me up as we're going downstairs so I wouldn't fall and so on. And I had pointed out that I came down from the 78th floor, and that didn't matter. The only thing that mattered and stopped them, and I'll tell you why I was doing it, the only thing that mattered and stopped them was when I said, look, I've got my friend David here who can see. It right. took the eyesight to get them to recognize that maybe we were okay. So why did I oppose their assistance? I mean, they were well-intentioned and so on. But they're a team, and I already knew that they had to carry all their equipment up the stairs with them to fight the fire. I mean, if you depended on there being equipment upstairs already, what floor do you put it on, and what's the guarantee that the emergency wouldn't be below where the equipment is so you couldn't get to it? So firefighters had to carry their equipment up with them, 60-pound packs and other things like that that they had to take with them to get up the stairs, oxygen cylinders, shovels, axes, and so on. So I did not want to break up their team. They'd have to split up somebody's pack or do something, or somebody would have been out of position. And how would I have felt if that night I heard that somebody got injured because another member of their team was helping a blind man down the stairs and doing a wonderful thing, but somebody got hurt up above because a teammate wasn't in position because they were doing something else? And it was needless to assist me to go down the stairs. There's no magic in walking down 78 flights of stairs or so, you know. So anyway, we worked through that, and they went up, and along the way we passed 50 firefighters going up, and then I and others said, can we do anything to help you? And they said, no, you go down and get out, and we'll deal with what's going on upstairs. So we were passed by men and women who went up to bravely deal with it.
Yeah, it's when you talk about that, you and I have, I think, a similar outlook on this, because, you know, listen, I've got a big, you know, 100 and some odd pound power wheelchair. And so when people see me, they want to help me. And yeah. There is that same thing that, you know, this is designed to keep me as independent as possible. And yeah. I didn't get here by people helping, you know, yes, I have had people help me in various ways, but, you know, there is also the side of this that for me, sometimes people are well-intentioned, but they don't have the experience and they don't have the understanding of what to do. And so I don't know, I'm just imagining something here. And that is, as you are going down, you are counting the number of stairs, you know where you are. When someone picks you up and carries you, now all of a sudden the orientation that you've had to your surroundings is changed based on the fact that, you know, your feet aren't on the ground having the sense to know exactly where you are. Is that right?
Well, no, not really. It isn't even that. Okay. It's that it's not necessary. If I can walk down the stairs, why shouldn't I? Why am I different than others? I don't even count stairs. I don't do that. It doesn't serve any purpose. All I care about is that the dog stops at the top of a flight of stairs and the dog stops at the bottom.
Okay.
Because that's what they're supposed to do.
Sure.
And you know, the fact is that it's more a matter for me of, like you, not only wanting independence, and I don't mind help, and I will take help when it's needed.
Definitely.
We all get help. We all need help. And it doesn't matter whether we can't walk or see, or we can, and we do see. We all need help from time to time. And there's a time to accept it, and a time to say, look, I've got this under control. And people should accept that. In other words, I'll take the help on my terms. And I'm open to always understanding more reasons why maybe somebody wants to help, but ultimately that should be my decision, not theirs. Yeah. And you know, it's the same. Well, my wife, she also uses a power chair, and mostly we, especially over the last year, have just been at home, so we haven't had a lot of it. But going out in public, it gets to be a whole different ballgame, as you understand.
Sure.
We were at an IKEA store one day, and somebody came up to me and said, I'm really sorry. It was a 13-year-old kid. He said, I'm really sorry. And I said, well, for what? And he said, well, you can't see. And I said, why does that matter? Well, you can't. And so you just can't, you can't do the things I can do. And I said, well, and I probably shouldn't have taken this tone exactly, but I said, I'm really sorry that you can see, because you really don't get it. It doesn't matter whether you can see or not. And then his mother pulled him away because he was talking to this blind man, and she was all concerned about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the bottom line is, it isn't the disability that is the issue. It's the public attitude about disabilities. And we can be and will and should be a part of that educational process. But I do have the right to demand that people learn to be more inclusive. How many times do you see in the Black Lives Matters movement or in the Me Too movement anyone say, and this includes people with disabilities,
right?
How many times last year during the presidential elections and all that went on did you see anyone talk about persons with disabilities? I remember Kamala Harris doing it once, quickly.
Right.
You know, and that's not to say that they won't do the right things, but we're not part of the discussion, and we are a 20% minority in the country. 20% of the people in this country have a disability, so why are we not part of the discussion? It's because they take that disability concept so seriously that we don't have abilities. And, you know, unfortunately, it's the term that exists, but I don't know of any other that's any better. So they've warped diversity not to include people with disabilities. So I can talk about disabilities as not including people who don't have ability. You know,
right.
it's a strange concept, but nevertheless.
No, I agree with you completely. And that is, people with disabilities are the largest minority group in the United States of America. And somehow we are the forgotten minority. And right. In that, even I've talked to some friends of mine to say that when it comes to the civil rights for people with disabilities, and when it comes to the advancement of people with disabilities, we are years behind most of the other minorities in what's going on. But can I run back to one thing that you said
away.
Earlier? You mentioned about websites and accessibility. And these days, every business, every entrepreneur, everybody has got a website out there. And you're talking about how to make those accessible. How difficult is it to make websites accessible? And can you give us some tips?
Well, it's not that it's difficult, but it's costly. The traditional way to make websites accessible has been that someone has to go in, and let's redefine accessible a bit. It has nothing to do, it has to do with persons who are blind or low vision, but it also has to do with many other disabilities. People, for example, who may not use a mouse, but have to use just a keyboard or an on-screen keyboard, or use a mouse stick to essentially simulate a keyboard. Those are all things that can be difficult to do depending on how one constructs their website. And Or a person with epilepsy who goes to a website and suddenly a pop-up appears where they're attracted to it by the blinking cursor, that could cause seizures. Those are all issues that need to be addressed in truly making a website inclusive for all. Accessibility is an experience, it's not code. So the traditional way is, however, that people would code websites. They would have to use alt tags to make image descriptions possible and put the descriptions on, even telling people there are images, or doing other things to make menus work properly and so on. 3 years ago, a company called Accessibee, spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E, came along and said, you know, there's a better way to do this, at least in part. And the better way is that we're going to use artificial intelligence. And what we're going to do is analyze a website if a person wants. And they do that by inserting a line of code that gives Accessibee access to the website. And then the system, the Accessibee system, creates, if you will, something that when anyone goes to the website, the Accessibee information is transmitted. So let me do it this way. I went to a website a few months ago to register an internet domain. I went to Namecheap.com. Being cheap, and it's the pandemic, I'll use Namecheap. So I went there, and as soon as I got to the site, the very first thing that I heard was, if you're using a screen reader, press Alt-1. I went, what's this about? And I looked around the site. I had used Namecheap before, although I knew it was difficult. I could kind of manipulate it. But I pressed Alt-1, and this website became completely available to me in ways that I had never been able to use it before. I could access menus, and I could look at even descriptions of images. Some of them weren't extremely accurate, but they were there. I got other information about simple tables and just being able to access different fields that I could never access before. So upon investigating, I discovered this company that was creating this essentially what you could call an artificial intelligence overlay. It doesn't change the code on the site, but it essentially to the browser looks like the code has been changed to make it possible for the entire system to become accessible to me as a blind person. And as I learned more about it, I learned that they were doing this for all types of disabilities. And in fact, anyone who goes to any site that uses Accessibee can manipulate the site along the lines of many different profiles that they can encounter to deal with whatever disability that they happen to have. And suddenly, what is a multi-$1,000 job usually becomes one that is $49 a month. And the reason it's $49 a month is that once they analyze your site, if you go in and you make changes, Accessibee will sense the changes and it will do what it needs to do to address the coding to continue inclusion on the website. My favorite example is that I updated my website around the same time I discovered Accessibee, and the coder didn't know a lot about what to do with it. He didn't know how to make accessibility work. He didn't know a lot about alt tags. He didn't make menus on my new site work as they should. And as much as I tried to work with him, he just couldn't get it. And his solution was, well, let's get rid of the menu. No, that's not the solution. The solution is to make it accessible. Sure. Then I discovered Accessibee and I put it on my site. And lo and behold, suddenly those menus all started working just as they should. And more important, I knew that I had some images on the page. For example, there was one that as I scrolled down the page after making it accessible with Accessibee, I heard this image described as, there's a man in a white dress shirt holding a yellow Labrador retriever. Now that was Accessibee's version of the image. Great start on the image, although, you know, who's the man and who's the dog? Well, the image was actually Michael Hinkson hugging Roselle. So we went in and we changed the alt tag. Accessibee noticed that, and so it won't try to change it back. But the point is that Accessibee and its artificial intelligence process goes so far as to be able to make an attempt at trying to describe images. There are things that it won't do. It's not great with bar graphs and pictorial charts, and it's not good yet with real image descriptions. It won't do very complicated tables and some other kinds of things well. So there is still room for coding. And very sophisticated, huge websites like an Amazon or a Target might not want to use Accessibility. They might want to just have it coded. And that works as long as they keep and maintain the accessibility. But for the millions, the hundreds of millions of websites more coming online every day, the small websites for shops that don't have a lot of money and can't afford coding, now they're thrust into a conundrum because the courts have said that the internet is a place of reasonable accommodation. And they have said, if you don't get your websites accessible, you can be sued. So it's the same thing that happened after the ADA when lawyers started running around looking for every single little thing that indicated that a wheelchair might have a problem going in somewhere. They would sue, and was all about making money, not truly making the website accessible.
Right.
So now with a $49 a month price tag, a shop any size can make its website accessible. A restaurant can make its website accessible. Unless they do something that makes the creating the menu that might change every day very difficult to read, like it being a not great image as opposed to putting the menu in words or in some other form on the site, then Accessibility will be able to help keep that website accessible. And it will, and Accessibility's team will also help people do those things that the program itself can't do so that they can maintain accessibility. So it's a really cool system. And already Accessibility has over 100,000 websites that it has made accessible. Coders haven't done that much in the last 2 years, and Accessibility has done that.
Fantastic. And I also was reading that it helps with your SEO as well.
Website accessibility in general does. Accessibility isn't there yet because the SEO operators haven't recognized, they haven't learned enough about it to recognize that Accessibility by making websites accessible should be indicated as a class of websites that's accessible. But okay, by making your website accessible, right now they do it by looking at your code. And in the future, they will also recognize that Accessibility and what it does will be just as much or more of a contributor to accessibility. So yes, it does improve SEO.
Excellent. All right. Thanks. Mike, you have shared a lot of information. Your story is fascinating, and I really appreciate that. If people are looking to get a hold of you and find you, where can they find you on the web?
Oh, on the web. They can visit my website, www.michaelhingson.com. That's michaelhingson.com. My contact info is there. They can reach me at contact@michaelhingson.com or mike@michaelhingson.com. They can also find me on Accessibility's website, www.accessibility.com, A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. And my email is michaelhi@accessibility.com. And I'm always glad to answer questions about Accessibility and just to answer people's questions in general. We haven't really talked about it, but out of September 11th, I wrote a book called Thunder Dog, The Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero, which has been a number one New York Times bestseller. And they can get that wherever they can buy books. And being a poor, starving author, as I love to say to people, we would appreciate people buying the book. And so we're pretty visible out there and always glad to engage.
Absolutely. And I will put links to all of those things, including your book, into the show notes so that people
can. Well, thank you.
Yep. And you, there's a free trial offer that goes with Accessibility. Is that right?
Ah, good point. Yes, there is. Anyone can go there and they can get it for 7 days and try it. If people want to see and compare Accessibility, I also have a version of my website and a subdomain we created without Accessibility being included. And that website is http://beforeaccessibility.michaelhingson.com. So if they go there, they'll see what the website was like. Of course, they may or may not really understand the menu issue, for example, unless they use a screen reader, but they can see what it is. And then they can go to michaelhingson.com, and at the top, they'll see a statement that, and a link that says for website help and accessibility statement, click here. And then they can go and they can see all the different profiles. And if they're not using a screen reader, they can at least go in and see how you can change the website for low vision people by enlarging fonts, changing contrasts, and so on. They can see what happens with a blinking cursor or getting rid of a blinking cursor. They can see all the other profiles that visually will make a difference.
Perfect. Mike, thank you so much for sharing, and I really appreciate your openness and willingness to give us both your story and the information for websites and helping websites to be accessible. Fantastic. I hope people take advantage of that. We have
I would love to do it again if you get a chance and want to.
Sure.
We'd love to.
We've come to three questions to establish your humanity. Are you ready for this?
Oh, sure.
What's your favorite way to spend a day off?
I love to read. In the last year, especially, my wife and I do a lot of reading. We love detective and mystery stories and so on. So we tend just to like to relax. I like quiet. Our favorite thing to do when we travel is cruising, but we're not doing that for a while. It's a little risky to be out on a boat, on a big ship or whatever. But we love to read, and we do it audio-wise. That is, my wife is a quilter. She likes to sew. So if I'm putzing around, or I also bake, I'm the baker and the griller in the family, we have a book going on in the background, so we both listen.
Excellent. So funny enough, the next question on my list is, what's the last book that you read, or the most recent thing that you would recommend?
The last book I read was The Law of Innocence by Michael Connelly. It's a Mickey Haller, Harry Bosch book. We just finished it last night. Again, we both read it. I believe in teamwork, and one of my favorite books in that regard is a small book entitled The Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni, which I recommend anyone read who is involved in any team effort, from a corporate team or whatever. It really puts teamwork in perspective and demonstrates the value of good teamwork. So that has always been one of my favorite books, and I urge people to read that.
Wonderful. Last question. What is your pièce de résistance when you're baking?
Oh, banana nut bread and chocolate chip cookies are probably the two biggest. I have a good chocolate chip cookie recipe with a secret ingredient that instead of using butter, we use Crisco butter sticks. So now the secret's out. But it really makes a difference. And I love to make banana nut bread. And when I worked in an office, every month or two, suddenly loaves of banana nut bread would appear in the little lunchroom with butter sticks, so we could have banana bread and butter. So I really enjoy that.
Wonderful. And I'm sure that everyone in the office enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, the bread didn't last very long. I can only say that. Sometimes I even got a piece.
Michael Hingson, thank you so much for being with me today. I appreciate it. To all my listeners, thank you for being here. I would encourage you to subscribe, leave us a review, or get in touch with us through the website. I will remind you that when you stop learning, you stop living. Have a great day, everybody.